black and white, brilliant under the sudden sun in a dazzling sky. Ahead of us, cleared and revealed by the same vast sweep of the wind, lay twisted valleys, hundreds of feet below, full of ice and boulders. Across those valleys a great wall stood, a wall of ice. And raising our eyes up, and still up to the rim of the wall, we saw the ice itself, the Gobrin Glacier, blinding and horizonless to the utmost north, a white the eyes could not look on. Here and there, out of the valleys full of rubble and out of the cliffs and bends and masses at the great ice field's edge, black ridges rose. One great mass loomed up out of the plateau to the height of the gateway peaks we stood between, and from its side drifted heavily a mile-long wisp of smoke. Farther off there were others, peaks, pinnacles, black cinder cones on the glacier. Smoke panted from fiery mouths that opened out of the ice. Estevan stood there in harness beside me, looking at that magnificent and unspeakable desolation. "I'm glad I have lived to see this," he said. I felt as he did. It is good to have an end to journey towards, but it is the journey that matters in the end. It had not rained here on these north-facing slopes. Snow fields stretched down from the pass into the valleys of moraine. We stowed the wheels, uncapped the sledge runners, put on our skis, and took off, down, north, onward into that silent vastness of fire and ice that said, in enormous letters of black and white, "Death." Death written right across the continent. The sledge pulled like a feather, and we laughed with joy. Chapter 16. Between Drumner and Dremagol. Odirni Thern. I asks from his sleeping bag, "What is it you're writing, Harth?" "A record." He laughs a little. "I ought to be keeping a journal for the ecumenical files, but I never could stick to it without a voice writer." I explain that my notes are intended for my people at Estra, who will incorporate them as they see fit into the records of the domain. This turning my thoughts to my hearth and my son, I seek to turn them away again and ask, Your parents, that is, are they alive?" "No," says I. 70 years dead." I puzzled at it. I was not 30 years old. "You're counting years of a different length than ours?" "No. Oh, I see. I've time-jumped 20 years from Earth to Hain Davenant, from 50 to Elul, from Elul to here, 17. I've only lived off Earth 7 years, but I was born there 120 years ago." Long since in Erenrang he had explained to me how time is shortened inside the ships that go almost as fast as starlight between the stars, but I had not laid this fact down against the length of a man's life or the lives he leaves behind him on his own world. While he lived a few hours in one of those unimaginable ships going from one planet to another, everyone he had left behind him at home grew old and died, and their children grew old. I said at last, "I thought myself in exile." "You for my sake, I for yours," he said, and laughed again, a slight cheerful sound in the heavy silence. "These 3 days since we came down from the pass have been much hard work for no gain. But I is no longer downcast nor over-hopeful, and he has more patience with me. Maybe the drugs are sweated out of him. Maybe we have learned to pull together. We spent this day coming down from the basaltic spur that we spent yesterday climbing. From the valley it looked a good road up onto the ice, but the higher we went the more scree and slick rock face we met, and a grade ever steeper, till even without the sledge we could not have climbed it. Tonight we are back down at the foot of it, in the moraine, the Valley of Stones. Nothing grows here. Rock, pebble dump, boulder fields, clay, mud. An arm of the glacier has withdrawn from this slope within the last 50 or 100 years, leaving the planet's bones raw to the air. No flesh of earth, of grass. Here and there, fumaroles cast a heavy yellowish fog over the ground, low and creeping. The air smells of sulfur. It is 12 degrees, still overcast. I hope no heavy snow falls until we have got over the evil ground between this place and the glacier arm we saw some miles to the west from the ridge. It seems to be a wide ice river running down from the plateau between two mountains, volcanoes, both capped with steam and smoke. If we can get onto it from the slopes of the nearer volcano, it may provide us a road up onto the plateau of ice. To our east, a smaller glacier comes down to a frozen lake, but it runs curving, and even from here the great crevasses in it can be seen. It is impassable to us, equipped as we are. We agreed to try the glacier between the volcanoes, though by going west to it we lose at least 2 days' mileage towards our goal, one in going west and one in regaining the distance. Apostathern. Snowing Neserim. Fine snow on a moderate gale, a light blizzard. No travel in this. We both slept all day. We have been hauling nearly a half month. The sleep does us good. Atormenvodthern. Snowing Neserim. Enough sleep. I taught me a Terran game played on squares with little stones called Go, an excellent difficult game. As he remarked, there are plenty of stones here to play Go with. He endures the cold pretty well, and if courage were enough, would stand it like a snow worm. It is odd to see him bundled up in hairband overcoat with the hood up when the temperature is above zero. But when we sledge, if the sun is out or the wind not too bitter, he takes off the coat soon and sweats like one of us. We must compromise as to the heating of the tent. He would keep it hot, I cold, and neither's comfort is the other's pneumonia. We strike a medium, and he shivers outside his bag, while I swelter in mine. But considering from what distance we have come together to share this tent a while, we do well enough. Gethany Fanern. Clear after the blizzard, wind down, the thermometer around 15 degrees all day, we are camped on the lower western slope of the nearer volcano, Mount Dremagol, on my map of Orgorin. Its companion across the ice river is called Drumner. The map is poorly made. There is a great peak visible to the west, not shown on it at all, and it is all out of proportion. The Orgota evidently do not often come into their fire hills. Indeed, there is not much to come for except grandeur. We hauled 11 miles today. Difficult work, all rock. I is asleep already. I bruised the tendon of my heel, wrenching it like a fool when my foot was caught between two boulders, and limped out the afternoon. The night's rest should heal it. Tomorrow we should get down onto the glacier. Our food supplies seem to have sunk alarmingly, but it is because we have been eating the bulky stuff. We had between 90 and 100 pounds of coarse foodstuffs, half of it the load I stole in Turuf. 60 pounds of this are gone, after 15 days' journey. I have started on the Gitche Mitche at a pound a day, saving 2 sacks of cuttick germ, some sugar, and a chest of dried fish cakes for variety later. I'm glad to be rid of that heavy stuff from Turuf. The sledge pulls lighter. Sordney Thanan. In the 20s, frozen rain, wind pouring down the ice river like the draft in a tunnel. Camped a quarter mile in from the edge, on a long flat streak of fern. The way down from Dremagol was rough and steep, on bare rock and rock fields, the glacier's edge heavily crevassed, and so foul with gravel and rocks caught in the ice that we tried the sledge on wheels there, too. Before we had got 100 yards, a wheel wedged fast, and the axle bent. We used runners henceforth. We made only 4 miles today, still in the wrong direction. The effluent glacier seems to run on a long curve westerly up to the Gobrin Plateau. Here, between the volcanoes, it is about 4 miles wide, and should not be hard going farther in towards the center, though it is more crevassed than I had hoped, and the surface rotten. Drumner is in eruption. The sleet on one's lips tastes of smoke and sulfur. A darkness lowered all day in the west, even under the rain clouds. From time to time all things, clouds, icy rain, ice, air, would turn a dull red, then fade slowly back to gray. The glacier shakes a little under our feet. As Kichwa Rem Ir Her hypothesized that the volcanic activity in northwest Ogorain and the archipelago has been increasing during the last 10 or 20 millennia, and presages the end of the ice, a recession of it, and an interglacial period. CO2 released by the volcanoes into the atmosphere will in time serve as an insulator, holding in the long-wave heat energy reflected from the Earth while permitting direct solar heat to enter undiminished. The average world temperature, he says, would in the end be raised some 30 degrees, till it attains 72 degrees. I am glad I shall not be present. I says that similar theories have been propounded by Terran scholars to explain the still incomplete recession of their last age of ice. All such theories remain largely irrefutable and unprovable. No one knows certainly why the ice comes, why it goes. The snow of ignorance remains untrodden. Over Drumner in the dark now, a great table of dull fire burns. Epps Thenern. The meter reads 16 miles haul today, but we are not more than 8 miles in a straight line from last night's camp. We are still in the ice pass between the two volcanoes. Drumner is in eruption. Worms of fire crawl down its black sides, seen when wind clears off the royal and seethe the ash cloud and smoke cloud and white steam. Continuously, with no pause, a hissing mutter fills the air, so huge and so long a sound that one cannot hear it when one stops to listen. Yet it fills all the interstices of one's being. The glacier trembles perpetually, snaps and crashes, jitters under our feet. All the snow bridges that the blizzard may have laid across crevasses are gone, shaken down, knocked in by this drumming and jumping of the ice and the earth beneath the ice. We go back and forth, seeking the end of a slit in the ice that would swallow the sledge whole, then seeking the end of the next, trying to go north and forced always to go west or east. Above us, Dremagol, in sympathy with Drumner's labor, grumbles and farts foul smoke. I's face was badly frostbitten this morning. Nose, ears, chin all dead gray when I chanced to look at him. Needed him back to life and no damage done, but we must be more careful. The wind that blows down off the ice is, in simple truth, deadly, and we have to face it as we haul. I should be glad to get off this slit and wrinkled ice arm between two growling monsters. Mountains should be seen, not heard. Arhad Thanen. Some silver snow, between 15 and 20 degrees. We went 12 miles today, about 5 of them profitable, and the rim of the Gobrin is visibly nearer north above us. We now see the ice river to be miles wide. The arm between Drumner and Dremagol is only one finger, and we now are on the back of the hand. Turning and looking down from this camp, one sees the glacier flow split, divided, torn and churned by the black, steaming peaks that thwart it. Looking ahead, one sees it broaden, rising and curving slowly, dwarfing the dark ridges of earth, meeting the ice wall far above, under veils of cloud and smoke and snow. Cinders and ash now fall with the snow, and the ice is thick with clinkers on it or sunk in it. A good walking surface, but rather rough for hauling, and the runners need recoating already. 2 or 3 times, volcanic projectiles hit the ice quite near us. They hiss loudly as they strike and burn themselves a socket in the ice. Cinders patter, falling with the snow. We creep infinitesimally northward through the dirty chaos of a world in the process of making itself. Praise, then, creation unfinished. Netherhad Thanen. No snow since morning. Overcast and windy at about 15 degrees. The great multiple glacier we are on feeds down into the valley from the west, and we are on its extreme eastern edge. Dremagol and Drumner are now somewhat behind us, though a sharp ridge of Dremagol still rises east of us almost at eye level. We have crept and crawled up to a point where we must choose between following the glacier on its long sweep westward and so up gradually onto the plateau of ice, or climbing the ice cliffs a mile north of tonight's camp and so saving 20 or 30 miles of hauling at the cost of risk. I favors the risk. There is a frailty about him. He is all unprotected, exposed, vulnerable, even to his sexual organ, which he must carry always outside himself. But he is strong, unbelievably strong. I am not sure he can keep hauling any longer than I can, but he can haul harder and faster than I, twice as hard. He can lift the sledge at front or rear to ease it over an obstacle. I could not lift and hold that weight unless I was in Dotha. To match his frailty and strength, he has a spirit easy to despair and quick to defiance, a fierce, impatient courage. This slow, hard, crawling work we have been doing these days wears him out in body and will, so that if he were one of my race I should think him a coward, but he is anything but that. He has a ready bravery I have never seen the like of. He is ready, eager, to stake life on the cruel, quick test of the precipice. Fire and fear, good servants, bad lords. He makes fear serve him. I would have let fear lead me around by the long way. Courage and reason are with him. What good seeking the safe course on a journey such as this? There are senseless courses, which I shall not take, but there is no safe one. Sreffanian. No luck. No way to get the sledge up, though we spent the day at it. Sova snow in flurries, thick ash mixed with it. It was dark all day as the wind, veering around from the west, again blew the pall of Drumner's smoke on us. Up here the ice shakes less, but there came a great quake while we tried to climb a shelving cliff. It shook free the sledge where we had wedged it, and I was pulled down 5 or 6 feet with a bump. But I had a good handhold, and his strength saved us from all careering down to the foot of the cliff, 20 feet or more. If one of us breaks a leg or shoulder in these exploits, that is probably the end of both of us. There, precisely, is the risk, rather an ugly one when looked at closely. The lower valley of the glaciers behind us is white with steam. Lava touches ice down there. We certainly cannot go back. Tomorrow we shall try the ascent farther west. Baron Thanern. No luck. We must go farther west. Dark as late twilight all day. Our lungs are raw, not from cold. It remains well above zero even at night with this west wind, but from breathing the ash and fumes of the eruption. By the end of this second day of wasted effort, scrabbling and squirming over pressure blocks and up ice cliffs, always to be stopped by a sheer face or overhang, trying farther on and failing again. I was exhausted and enraged. He looked ready to cry, but did not. I believe he considers crying either evil or shameful. Even when he was very ill and weak the first days of our escape, he hid his face from me when he wept. Reasons personal, racial, social, sexual. How can I guess why I must not weep? Yet his name is a cry of pain. For that I first sought him out in Erenrang, a long time ago it seems now. Hearing talk of an alien, I asked his name and heard, for answer, a cry of pain from a human throat across the night. Now he sleeps. His arms tremble and twitch. Muscular fatigue. The world around us, ice and rock, ash and snow, fire and dark, trembles and twitches and mutters. Looking out a minute ago, I saw the glow of the volcano as a dull red bloom on the belly of vast clouds overhanging the darkness. Ornithanen. No luck. This is the 22nd day of our journey, and since the 10th day we have made no progress eastward. Indeed, have lost 20 or 25 miles by going west. Since the 18th day we have made no progress of any kind and might as well have sat still. If we ever do get up on the ice, will we have food enough left to take us across it? This thought is hard to dismiss. Fog and murk of the eruption cut seeing very close, so that we cannot choose our path well. I want to attack each ascent, however steep, that shows any sign of shelving. He is impatient with my caution. We have got to watch our tempers. I will be in Kenner in a day or so, and all strains will increase. Meanwhile, we butt our heads on cliffs of ice in a cold dusk full of ashes. If I wrote a new Yomesh canon, I should send thieves here after death. Thieves who steal sacks of food by night in Turuf. Thieves who steal a man's hearth and name from him, and send him out ashamed and exiled. My head is thick. I must cross out all this stuff later, too tired to reread it now. Harahad Thanem on the Gobrin. The 23rd day of our journey. We are on the Gobrin ice. As soon as we set out this morning, we saw, only a few hundred yards beyond last night's camp, a pathway open up to the ice, a highway curving broad and cinder-paved from the rubble and chasms of the glacier right up through the cliffs of ice. We walked up it as if strolling along the Sess embankment. We are on the ice. We are headed east, again, homeward. I am infected by eyes' pure pleasure in our achievement. Looked at soberly, it is as bad as ever up here. We are on the plateau's rim. Crevasses, some wide enough to sink villages in, not house by house but all at once, run inland, northward, right out of sight. Most of them cut across our way, so we too must go north, not east. The surface is bad. We screw the sledge along amongst great lumps and chunks of ice, immense debris pushed up by the straining of the great plastic sheet of ice against and among the fire hills. The broken pressure ridges take queer shapes, overturned towers, legless giants, catapults. A mile thick to start with, the ice here rises and thickens, trying to flow over the mountains and choke the fire mouths with silence. Some miles to the north, a peak rises up out of the ice, the sharp, graceful, barren cone of a young volcano. Younger by thousands of years than the ice sheet that grinds and shoves, all shattered into chasms and jammed up into great blocks and ridges over the 6,000 feet of lower slopes we cannot see. During the day, turning, we saw the smoke of Drumner's eruption hang behind us like a gray-brown extension of the surface of the ice. A steady wind blows along at ground level from the northeast, clearing this higher air of the soot and stink of the planet's bowels, which we have breathed for days, flattening out the smoke behind us to cover, like a dark lid, the glaciers, the lower mountains, the valleys of stones, the rest of the earth. There is nothing, the ice says, but ice. But the young volcano there to northward has another word it thinks of saying. No snowfall. A thin, high overcast. -4 degrees on the plateau at dusk. A jumble of fern, new ice, and old ice underfoot. The new ice is tricky, slick blue stuff just hidden by a white glaze. We have both been down a good deal. I slid 15 feet on my belly across one such slick. I, in harness, doubled up laughing. He apologized and explained he had thought himself the only person on Geffen who ever slipped on ice. 13 miles today. But if we try to keep up such a pace among these cut, heaped, crevassed pressure ridges, we shall wear ourselves out, or come to worse grief than a belly slide. The waxing moon is low, dull as dry blood. A great, brownish, iridescent halo surrounds it. Gwirnethanen. Some snow, rising wind and falling temperature. 13 miles again today, which brings our distance logged since we left our first camp to 254 miles. We have averaged about 10.5 miles a day, 11.5 omitting the 2 days spent waiting out the blizzard. 75 to 100 of those miles of hauling gave us no onward gain. We are not much nearer Carhide than we were when we set out. But we stand a better chance, I think, of getting there. Since we came up out of the volcano, Merc, our spirit is not all spent in work and worry, and we talk again in the tent after our dinner. As I am in Kemmer, I would find it easier to ignore Ai's presence, but this is difficult in a two-man tent. The trouble is, of course, that he is, in his curious fashion, also in Kemmer. Always in Kemmer. A strange, low-grade sort of desire it must be, to be spread out over every day of the year and never to know the choice of sex. But there it is. And here am I. Tonight, my extreme physical awareness of him was rather hard to ignore. And I was too tired to divert it into untrance or any other channel of the discipline. Finally, he asked, had he offended me? I explained my silence with some embarrassment. I was afraid he would laugh at me. After all, he is no more an oddity, a sexual freak, than I am. Up here on the ice, each of us is singular, isolate. I, as cut off from those like me, from my society and its rules, as he from his. There is no world full of other Gathenians here to explain and support my existence. We are equals at last. Equal. Alien. Alone. He did not laugh, of course. Rather, he spoke with a gentleness that I did not know was in him. After a while, he too came to speak of isolation, of loneliness. Your race is appallingly alone in its world. No other mammalian species, no other ambisexual species, no animal intelligent enough even to domesticate as pets. It must color your thinking, this uniqueness. I don't mean scientific thinking only, though you are extraordinary hypothesizers. It's extraordinary that you arrived at any concept of evolution, faced with that unbridgeable gap between yourselves and the lower animals. But philosophically, emotionally, to be so solitary in so hostile a world, it must affect your entire outlook. The Omeshta would say that man's singularity is his divinity. Lords of the earth, yes, other cults on other worlds have come to the same conclusion. They tend to be the cults of dynamic, aggressive, ecology-breaking cultures. Ogorain is in the pattern in its way. At least they seem bent on pushing things around. What do the Handarata say? Well, in the Handara, you know, there's no theory, no dogma. Maybe they are less aware of the gap between men and beasts, being more occupied with the likenesses, the links, the whole of which living things are a part. Tormer's lay had been all day in my mind, and I said the words, "Light is the left hand of darkness, and darkness the right hand of light. Two are one, life and death, lying together like lovers in Kemmer, like hands joined together like the end and the way." My voice shook as I said the lines, for I remembered as I said them that in the letter my brother wrote me before his death he had quoted the same words. I brooded, and after some time he said, "You're isolated and undivided. Perhaps you are as obsessed with wholeness as we are with dualism." We are dualists, too. Duality is an essential, isn't it? So long as there is myself and the other. "I and thou," he said. "Yes, it does, after all, go even wider than sex. Tell me, how does the other sex of your race differ from yours?" He looked startled, and in fact my question rather startled me. Kemmer brings out these spontaneities in one. We are both self-conscious. "I never thought of that," he said. "You've never seen a woman." He used his Terran language word, which I knew.
"I saw your pictures of them. The women look like
pregnant Gathenians, but with larger breasts. Do they differ much from your sex in mind behavior? Are they like a different species? No. Yes. No, of course not. Not really. But the difference is very important. I suppose the most important thing, the heaviest single factor in one's life, is whether one's born male or female. In most societies, it determines one's expectations, activities, outlook, ethics, manners, almost everything. Vocabulary, semiotic usages, clothing, even food. Women tend to eat less. It's extremely hard to separate the innate differences from the learned ones. Even where the women participate equally with men in the society, they still, after all, do all the childbearing, and so most of the child-rearing. Equality is not the general rule, then? Are they mentally inferior? I don't know. They don't often seem to turn up mathematicians or composers of music or inventors or abstract thinkers. But it isn't that they are stupid. Physically, they're less muscular, but a little more durable than men. Psychologically, after he had stared a long time at the glowing stove, he shook his head. "Arf," he said, "I can't tell you what women are like. I never thought about it much in the abstract, you know, and, God, by now I've practically forgotten. I've been here 2 years. You don't know. In a sense, women are more alien to me than you are. With you, I share one sex, anyhow." He looked away and laughed, rueful and uneasy. My own feelings were complex, and we let the matter drop. Unithanern. 18 miles today. East-northeast by compass, on skis. We got clear of the pressure ridges and crevasses in the first hour of pulling. Both got in harness, I ahead at first with the probe, but no more need for testing. The fern is a couple of feet thick over solid ice. And on the fern lies several inches of sound, new snow from the last fall, with a good surface. Neither we nor the sledge broke through at all, and the sledge pulled so light that it was hard to believe we are still hauling about 100 pounds apiece. During the afternoon we took turns hauling, as one can do it easily on this splendid surface. It is a pity that all the hard work uphill and over rock came while the load was heavy. Now we go light. Too light. I find myself thinking about food a good deal. "We eat," I says, "ethereally." All day we went light and fast over the level ice plain, dead white under a gray-blue sky. Unbroken except for the few black Nunatak peaks now far behind us, and a smudge of darkness, Drumner's breath behind them. Nothing else. The veiled sun, the ice. Chapter 17. An Ogota Creation Myth. The origins of this myth are prehistorical. It has been recorded in many forms. This very primitive version is from a pre-Yomesh written text found in the Isenpef Cave shrine of the Gobrin hinterlands. In the beginning there was nothing but ice and the sun. Over many years, the sun shining melted a great crevasse in the ice. In the sides of this crevasse were great shapes of ice, and there was no bottom to it. Drops of water melted from the ice shapes in the sides of the chasm and fell down and down. One of the ice shapes said, "I bleed." Another of the ice shapes said, "I weep." A third one said, "I sweat." The ice shapes climbed up out of the abyss and stood on the plain of ice. He that said, "I bleed," he reached up to the sun and pulled out handfuls of excrement from the bowels of the sun, and with that dung made the hills and valleys of the earth. He that said, "I weep," he breathed on the ice and, melting it, made the seas and the rivers. He that said, "I sweat," he gathered up soil and seawater and with them made trees, plants, herbs and grains of the field, animals and men. The plants grew in the soil and the sea, the beasts ran on the land and swam in the sea. But the men did not wake. 39 of them there were. They slept on the ice and would not move. Then the three ice shapes stood down and sat with their knees drawn up and let the sun melt them. As milk they melted, and the milk ran into the mouths of the sleepers, and the sleepers woke. That milk is drunk by the children of men alone, and without it they will not wake to life. The first to wake up was Edondarath. So tall was he that when he stood up his head split the sky, and snow fell down. He saw the others stirring and awakening, and was afraid of them when they moved, so he killed one after another with a blow of his fist. 36 of them he killed. But one of them, the next to last one, ran away. Aharath he was called. Far he ran, over the plain of ice and over the lands of earth. Edondarath ran behind him and caught up with him at last, and smote him. Aharath died. Then Edondarath returned to the birthplace on the Gobrin ice, where the bodies of the others lay, but the last one was gone. He had escaped, while Edondarath pursued Aharath. Edondarath built a house of the frozen bodies of his brothers, and waited there inside that house for that last one to come back. Each day one of the corpses would speak, saying, "Does he burn? Does he burn?" All the other corpses would say with frozen tongues, "No, no." Then Edondarath entered Kemer as he slept, and moved and spoke aloud in dreams, and when he woke, the corpses were all saying, "He burns, he burns." And the last brother, the youngest one, heard them saying that, and came into the house of bodies, and there coupled with Edondarath. Of these two were the nations of men born, out of the flesh of Edondarath, out of Edondarath's womb. The name of the other, the younger brother, the father, his name is not known. Each of the children born to them had a piece of darkness that followed him about wherever he went by daylight. Edondarath said, "Why are my sons followed thus by darkness?" His Kemmering said, "Because they were born in the house of flesh. Therefore death follows at their heels. They are in the middle of time. In the beginning there was the sun and the ice, and there was no shadow. In the end, when we are done, the sun will devour itself, and shadow will eat light, and there will be nothing left but the ice and the darkness." Chapter 18. On the Ice. Sometimes, as I am falling asleep in a dark, quiet room, I have for a moment a great and treasurable illusion of the past. The wall of a tent leans up over my face, not visible but audible, a slanting plane of faint sound, the susurrus of blown snow. Nothing can be seen. The light emission of the Chabe stove is cut off, and it exists only as a sphere of heat, a heart of warmth. The faint dampness and confining cling of my sleeping bag, the sound of the snow barely audible, Estravan's breathing as he sleeps. Darkness. Nothing else. We are inside, the two of us, in shelter, at rest, at the center of all things. Outside, as always, lies the great darkness, the cold, death's solitude. In such fortunate moments as I fall asleep, I know beyond doubt what the real center of my own life is. That time that is past and lost and yet is permanent. The enduring moment. The heart of warmth. I am not trying to say that I was happy during those weeks of hauling a sledge across an ice sheet in the dead of winter. I was hungry, overstrained, and often anxious, and it all got worse the longer it went on. I certainly wasn't happy. Happiness has to do with reason, and only reason earns it. What I was given was the thing you can't earn and can't keep and often don't even recognize at the time. I mean, joy. I always woke up first, usually before daylight. My metabolic rate is slightly over the Gathenian norm, as are my height and weight. Esther, then, had figured these differences into the food ration calculations in his scrupulous way, which one could see as either housewifely or scientific. And from the start, I had had a couple of ounces more food per day than he. Protests of injustice fell silent before the self-evident justice of this unequal division. However divided, the share was small. I was hungry, constantly hungry, daily hungrier. I woke up because I was hungry. If it was still dark, I turned up the light of the Chabe stove and put a pan of ice brought in the night before, now thawed, on the stove to boil. Estevan, meanwhile, engaged in his customary fierce and silent struggle with sleep, as if he wrestled with an angel. Winning, he sat up, stared at me vaguely, shook his head, and woke. By the time we were dressed and booted, and had the bags rolled up, breakfast was ready. A mug of boiling hot orsh, and one cube of gichi-michi expanded by hot water into a sort of small, doughy bun. We chewed slowly, solemnly, retrieving all dropped crumbs. The stove cooled as we ate. We packed it up with the pan and mugs, pulled on our hooded overcoats and our mittens, and crawled out into the open air. The coldness of it was perpetually incredible. Every morning I had to believe it all over again. If one had been outside to relieve oneself already, the second exit was only harder. Sometimes it was snowing, sometimes the long light of early day lay wonderfully gold and blue across the miles of ice. Most often it was gray. We brought the thermometer into the tent with us nights, and when we took it outside it was interesting to watch the pointer swing to the right. Gathenian dials read counterclockwise, almost too fast to follow, registering a drop of 25, 50, 80 degrees, till it stopped somewhere between 0 and -60. One of us collapsed the tent and folded it, while the other loaded stove, bags, etc., onto the sledge. The tent was strapped over all, and we were ready for skis and harness. Little metal was used in our straps and fittings, but the harnesses had buckles of aluminum alloy, too fine to fasten with mittens on, which burned in that cold exactly as if they were red-hot. I had to be very careful of my fingers when the temperature was below -20, especially if the wind blew, for I could pick up a frostbite amazingly fast. My feet never suffered, and that is a factor of major importance in a winter journey where an hour's exposure can, after all, cripple one for a week or for life. Estevan had had to guess my size, and the snow boots he got me were a little large, but extra socks filled the discrepancy. We put on our skis, got into harness as quick as possible, bucked and pried and jolted the sledge free if its runners were frozen in, and set off. Mornings after heavy snowfall, we might have to spend some while digging out the tent and sledge before we could set off. The new snow was not hard to shovel away, though it made great impressive drifts around us, who were, after all, the only impediment for hundreds of miles, the only thing sticking out above the ice. We pulled eastward by the compass. The usual direction of the wind was north to south, off the glacier. Day after day it blew from our left as we went. The hood did not suffice against that wind, and I wore a facial mask to protect my nose and left cheek. Even so, my left eye froze shut one day, and I thought I had lost the use of it. Even when Estevan thawed it open with breath and tongue, I could not see with it for some while, so probably more had been frozen than the lashes. In sunlight, both of us wore the Gathenian slit-screen eye shields, and neither of us suffered any snow blindness. We had small opportunity. The ice, as Estevan had said, tends to hold a high-pressure zone above its central area, where thousands of square miles of white reflect the sunlight. We were not in this central zone, however, but at best on the edge of it, between it and the zone of turbulent, deflected, precipitation-laden storms that it sends continually to torment the subglacial lands. Wind from due north brought bare, bright weather, but from northeast or northwest it brought snow, or harrowed up dry fallen snow into blinding, biting clouds like sand or dust storms, or else, sinking almost to nothing, crept in sinuous trails along the surface, leaving the sky white, the air white, no visible sun, no shadow, and the snow itself, the ice, disappeared from under our feet. Around midday we would halt and cut and set up a few blocks of ice for a protective wall if the wind was strong. We heated water to soak a cube of gitchy-mitchy in, and drank the water hot, sometimes with a bit of sugar melted in it, harnessed up again and went on. We seldom talked while on the march or at lunch, for our lips were sore, and when one's mouth was open the cold got inside, hurting teeth and throat and lungs. It was necessary to keep the mouth closed and breathe through the nose, at least when the air was 40 or 50 degrees below freezing. When it went on lower than that, the whole breathing process was further complicated by the rapid freezing of one's exhaled breath. If you didn't look out, your nostrils might freeze shut, and then, to keep from suffocating, you would gasp in a lungful of razors. Under certain conditions, our exhalations freezing instantly made a tiny cracking noise like distant firecrackers, and a shower of crystals, each breath a snowstorm. We pulled till we were tired out or till it began to grow dark, halted, set up the tent, pegged down the sledge if there was threat of high wind, and settled in for the night. On a usual day we would have pulled for 11 or 12 hours and made between 12 and 18 miles. It does not seem a very good rate, but then conditions were a bit adverse. The crust of the snow was seldom right for both skis and sledge runners. When it was light and new, the sledge ran through rather than over it. When it was partly hardened, the sledge would stick, but we on skis would not, which meant that we were perpetually being pulled up backward with a jolt. And when it was hard, it was often heaped up in long wind waves, sastrugi, that in some places ran up to 4 feet high. We had to haul the sledge up and over each knife-edged or fantastically corniced top, then slither down and up over the next one, for they never seemed to run parallel to our course. I had imagined the Gobind Ice Plateau to be all one sheet like a frozen pond, but there were hundreds of miles of it that were rather like an abruptly frozen, storm-raised sea. The business of setting up camp, making everything secure, getting all the clinging snow off one's outer clothing and so on, was trying. Sometimes it did not seem worthwhile. It was so late, so cold, one was so tired that it would be much easier to lie down in a sleeping bag in the lee of the sledge and not bother with the tent. I remember how clear this was to me on certain evenings, and how bitterly I resented my companion's methodical, tyrannical insistence that we do everything and do it correctly and thoroughly. I hated him at such times, with a hatred that rose straight up out of the depth that lay within my spirit. I hated the harsh, intricate, obstinate demands that he made on me in the name of life. When all was done, we could enter the tent, and almost at once the heat of the Chabe stove could be felt as an enveloping, protecting ambience. A marvelous thing surrounded us. Warmth, death and cold were elsewhere, outside. Hatred was also left outside. We ate and drank. After we ate, we talked. When the cold was extreme, even the excellent insulation of the tent could not keep it out, and we lay in our bags as close to the stove as possible. A little fur of frost gathered on the inner surface of the tent. To open the valve was to let in a draft of cold that instantly condensed, filling the tent with a swirling mist of fine snow. When there was a blizzard, needles of icy air blew in through the vents, elaborately protected as they were, and an impalpable dust of snow motes fogged the air. On those nights, the storm made an incredible noise, and we could not converse by voice unless we shouted with our heads together. On other nights it was still, with such a stillness as one imagines as existing before the stars begin to form, or after everything has perished. Within an hour after our evening meal, Estravan turned the stove down, if it was feasible to do so, and turned the light emission off. As he did so, he murmured a short and charming grace of invocation, the only ritual words I had ever learned of the Hundera. "Praise, then, darkness and creation unfinished," he said. And there was darkness. We slept. In the morning, it was all to do over. We did it over for 50 days. Estevan kept up his journal, though during the weeks on the ice he seldom wrote more than a note of the weather and the distance we had come that day. Among these notes there is occasional mention of his own thoughts or of some of our conversation, but not a word concerning the profounder conversation between us that occupied our rest between dinner and sleep on many nights of the first month on the ice, while we still had enough energy to talk and on certain days that we spent storm-bound in the tent. I told him that I was not forbidden, but not expected, to use paraverbal speech on a non-ally planet, and asked him to keep what he learned from his own people at least until I could discuss what I had done with my colleagues on the ship. He assented and kept his word. He never said or wrote anything concerning our silent conversations. Mind speech was the only thing I had to give Estevan out of all my civilization, my alien reality in which he was so profoundly interested. I could talk and describe endlessly, but that was all I had to give. Indeed, it may be the only important thing we have to give to Winter. But I can't say that gratitude was my motive for infringing on the law of cultural embargo. I was not paying my debt to him. Such debts remain owing. Estevan and I had simply arrived at the point where we shared whatever we had that was worth sharing. I expect it will turn out that sexual intercourse is possible between Githinian double-sexed and Hainish norm one-sexed human beings, though such intercourse will inevitably be sterile. It remains to be proved. Estevan and I proved nothing except perhaps a rather subtler point. The nearest to crisis that our sexual desires brought us was on a night early in the journey, our second night up on the ice. We had spent all day struggling and backtracking in the cut-up, crevassed area east of the Fire Hills. We were tired that evening, but elated, sure that a clear course would soon open out ahead. But after dinner, Estevan grew taciturn and cut my talk off short. I said at last, after a direct rebuff, "Harth, I've said something wrong again. Please tell me what it is." He was silent. "I've made some mistake in Shifgrethor. I'm sorry. I can't learn. I've never even really understood the meaning of the word."
"Shifgrethor?"
"It comes from an old word for shadow." We were both silent for a little, and then he looked at me with a direct, gentle gaze. His face, in the reddish light, was as soft, as vulnerable, as remote as the face of a woman who looks at you out of her thoughts and does not speak. And I saw then, again and for good, what I had always been afraid to see and had pretended not to see in him, that he was a woman as well as a man. Any need to explain the sources of that fear vanished with the fear. What I was left with was, at last, acceptance of him as he was. Until then I had rejected him, refused him his own reality. He had been quite right to say that he, the only person on Gethin who trusted me, was the only Gethinian I distrusted, for he was the only one who had entirely accepted me as a human being, who had liked me personally and given me entire personal loyalty, and who therefore had demanded of me an equal degree of recognition, of acceptance. I had not been willing to give it. I had been afraid to give it. I had not wanted to give my trust, my friendship, to a man who was a woman. A woman who was a man. He explained, stiffly and simply, that he was in Kemmer, and had been trying to avoid me insofar as one of us could avoid the other.
"I must not touch you," he said,
with extreme constraint. Saying that, he looked away. I said, "I understand. I agree completely." For it seemed to me, and I think to him, that it was from that sexual tension between us admitted now and understood, but not assuaged, that the great and sudden assurance of friendship between us rose. A friendship so much needed by us both in our exile, and already so well proved in the days and nights of our bitter journey that it might as well be called, now as later, love. But it was from the difference between us, not from the affinities and likenesses, but from the difference, that that love came. And it was itself the bridge, the only bridge, across what divided us. For us to meet sexually would be for us to meet once more as aliens. We had touched in the only way we could touch. We left it at that. I do not know if we were right. We talked some more that night, and I recall being very hard put to it to answer coherently when he asked me what women were like. We were both rather stiff and cautious with each other for the next couple of days. A profound love between two people involves, after all, the power and chance of doing profound hurt. It would never have occurred to me before that night that I could hurt Esraven. Now that the barriers were down, the limitation in my terms of our converse and understanding seemed intolerable to me. Quite soon, two or three nights later, I said to my companion, as we finished our dinner, a special treat, sugared kadik porridge, to celebrate a 20-mile run. Last spring, that night in the corner red dwelling, you said you wished I'd tell you more about paraverbal speech.
Yes, I did.
Do you want to see if I can teach you how to speak it? He laughed.
You want to catch me lying?
If you ever lied to me, it was long ago, and in another country. He was an honest person, but rarely a direct one. That tickled him, and he said, "In another country I may tell you other lies. But I thought you were forbidden to teach your mind science to the natives until we joined the Ecumen." "Not forbidden. It's not done. I'll do it, though, if you like. And if I can, I'm no educer." "There are special teachers of the skill?" "Yes. Not on Altera, where there's a high occurrence of natural sensitivity, and, they say, mothers' minds speak to their unborn babies. I don't know what the babies answer, but most of us have to be taught as if it were a foreign language, or rather as if it were our native language, but learned very late." I think he understood my motive in offering to teach him the skill, and he wanted very much to learn it. We had a go at it. I recalled what I could of how I had been educed at age 12. I told him to clear his mind, let it be dark. This he did, no doubt, more promptly and thoroughly than I ever had done. He was an adept of the Handara, after all. Then I mind-spoke to him as clearly as I could. No result. We tried it again. Since one cannot bespeak until one has been bespoken, until the telepathic potentiality has been sensitized by one clear reception. I had to get through to him first. I tried for half an hour, till I felt hoarse of brain. He looked crestfallen. "I thought it would be easy for me," he confessed. We were both tired out, and called the attempt off for the night. Our next efforts were no more successful. I tried sending to Esterven while he slept, recalling what my inducer had told me about the occurrence of dream messages among pre-telepathic peoples, but it did not work.
"Perhaps my species lacks the capacity," he said.
"We have enough rumors and hints to have made up a word for the power, but I don't know of any proven instances of telepathy among us." So it was with my people for thousands of years. A few natural sensitives, not comprehending their gift, and lacking anyone to receive from or send to. All the rest, latent, if that. You know, I told you that, except in the case of the born sensitive, the capacity, though it has a physiological basis, is a psychological one. A product of culture, a side effect of the use of the mind.
Young children and defectives and members of unevolved or regressed societies can't mind-speak. The mind must exist on a certain plane of complexity.